Okay, I'm looking forward to your phone calls now with our special guest. Final hour now with Dr. Raymond Moody. His website, of course, is called lifeafterlife.com. He's written a number of books, but the big one, Life After Life, that was turned into a movie, by the way, a long time ago. Raymond, I've got to tell you, I am absolutely enjoying this discussion with you tonight.
Yeah, me too. Thank you so much.
It's fun, fun, fun. And do you travel much? Do you go to conferences or anything like that?
I do quite a bit, George, but at the same time, believe it or not, I have two grown sons who are doing great, and believe it or not, I have also a 9-year-old son and a 6-year-old daughter that we adopted them both at birth, and that's really kind of occupies a lot of my time. But yeah, I travel. I'm getting ready to go to Egypt and Greece for 3 weeks, for example, to lead a tour to the ancient oracle sites in those countries.
Something.
So, yeah, I travel, and I really do enjoy lecturing.
Now, the ancient Egyptians, they were believers in the afterlife.
Oh, yeah, that seemed to be sort of the focal point of their society, wasn't it?
Sure was. Let's take some calls. This hour's going to go by very quickly. West of the Rockies, you're on the air with us. Where are you calling from?
Yes, hello, George. I'm calling from Las Vegas.
Hi.
And it's nice to speak to you. And Dr. Moody, it's a pleasure to listen to you and to speak to you. I have something here that I feel is proof. I want to know what you thought.
Mm-hmm.
I've never been sick or near death or anything like that. I've been very healthy.
Mm-hmm.
5 months after my sister passed on,
uh-huh.
I was lying in bed. I was not overly grieving. I was reading because I was wide awake. The pragmatic book. It was Emerson's Self-Reliance.
Uh-huh.
So nothing weird or anything.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, and I'm wide awake, all of a sudden, just as though someone had thrown a switch, I got so fatigued, my eyes felt like they weighed 50 pounds each,
mm-hmm.
and I thought, oh, this is strange. I leaned over, turned off the light, turned the book kind of on my stomach upside down, you know.
Uh-huh.
Within a few seconds, Dr. Moody, I've got to tell you this, I was out of my body, and I could see my body on the bed and see the book. All of a sudden, my left hand, someone took my left hand, and it felt like flesh. Maybe it wasn't the same kind of body, but whatever it was my sister. And I turned to her, and I said, Cherry, it's you. You know, I was exuberant. She said, well, of course it is. We went to, all I can say is a place. There were a lot of people there. There was an alabaster gazebo. And I said, am I dead? Because, of course, since she had passed on, she said, no, nobody is dead. And we sat at this little table, and she said, I want you to tell everyone in the family that I'm fine, I'm not sick, everything is hunky-dory. That was her favorite expression. Can I rely on you, she said. I said, of course. And I said, are those people dead? She said, no, I told you, no one is dead. I said, can they see me? She said, if they want to. The next thing I know, we're kind of flying back. This time, my right hand is holding hers. And within 2 seconds, it seemed, she was no longer there. I went right through the top of the apartment building. There was my body, and my body jerked resoundingly. I sat up exuberant, refreshed, and I wrote every bit of it down, Dr. Moody, and sent a copy to everyone in the family. I guess you must know that the last people that believe you are relatives, because they say, oh, it was probably a dream. But I am telling you, I know the difference between a dream. This was real, and I said, dear God, this is actual. And I wanted to know, I'll listen off the air, off the phone, I wanted to know if you've run into anything like that, where someone was not ill but had an out-of-body experience and met up with someone who passed on. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am, and thank you for that story, and absolutely, I hear that all the time. You don't have to be near death to have an out-of-body experience or other kind of experience, a spiritual experience like that. And you, obviously, to you, that was completely reassuring, and I respect that totally. In other words, when somebody has their own personal transcendent experience, nobody else is in a position to be able to contradict their experience. So for you, I respect absolutely that that was, that satisfies you on the question of life after death. So, and the way I look at it, if somebody has a transcendental near-death experience and that personal experience convinces them that there's an afterlife, then it's ridiculous for anybody else to disagree with that point of view. The question of whether we can use experiences like that and some sort of rational procedure to prove it to people who have not had such experiences is a different issue. But that doesn't really matter to the people who've had experiences. I think I absolutely respect what you're saying, that if somebody has had their own personal experience, then absolutely they are entitled to interpret that in their own life the way they want to, absolutely.
Raymond, what would it take to get you absolutely convinced about the other side?
You know, George, I don't know, but I'll tell you the truth. First of all, reason is a collective thing. In other words, it has to be to, when you put it in a rational context, that means you bring it out into a public context so that anybody going through the rules and following the procedures correctly would come to the same conclusion. And so I don't really know. I think that the real problem is that we need that the rules, that the procedures of rational investigation, as wonderful as they are, like the scientific method, for example, are not really adequate yet to prove the question of life after death. And so to me, now some people hear that as like a discouraging thing. To me, that's really exciting, because what that means to me is that opens that the possibility of let's find some new methods of rational investigation. That's where I am really excited, you see, because I think it's perfectly possible to devise new principles of reason and logic that can get us a little closer to the problem, and that's where I'm working. And as a matter of fact, I'd like to say that I have been, for about 3 years, I've been issuing a challenge, and nobody, to my astonishment, has taken up.
And what is that?
And that is that if I could, I would need about 120 subjects to demonstrate this with, and I would have to probably take them about 12 at a time. And they would have to go by my criteria, which in my criteria of selection would be that these would be people who can follow a rational argument and who are willing to sit still patiently and reason through a case for themselves, kind of like a jury. I can imagine this like a jury. And I would have to choose people who aren't prejudiced either way, who don't go into this believing in an afterlife or already have a preformed disbelief in an afterlife. But I guarantee you that I could take those people, and in a 3-day period, I could guide them through a procedure where at the end of it, they would absolutely agree that I have actually made a small advance that will absolutely stand up on the question of life after death. But even more than that, that in that 3 days, I could open up a whole untapped region of their mind that would not just bring the question of life after death into better perspective, but that would open up a lot of other areas of the mind too, and apply to a lot of other important problems. And I can absolutely do that. I mean, I don't say things until I know I'm correct, and I can do this.
Okay, let's go back to the phones. We'll go to our wild card line. Welcome to Coast to Coast. You are on the air with us. Hi there. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, Hello, this is Shane from New Orleans.
Hey, Shane, thanks for calling.
Oh, thanks a lot. Good evening, gentlemen. I hope my message finds you well.
And likewise, hope you're doing well.
Thank you very much. I'll be very quick with respect to the rest of the callers. But first, the fact of the Ouija board, my sister and I, at the age of 12 and 16, respectively, we used it once, and with a single candle lit, of course, coincidentally, and every single question it answered was true. 3 days later, I walked in, and my sister and her friend were using the Ouija board, and they asked a question for me of when was my first kiss. Mm-hmm. Well, I told them it was 12, but the board said 13, and I said, no, the board's lying. It's a, you know. Well, from that point on, they both thought it was a hoax. They never used it again. But I myself knew that every single question that it was ever asked was true.
Mm-hmm.
So my question is, aside from that, was when you're using, Dr. Moody, when you're using your mirror technique, with your candles lit, of course, is the mirror perpendicular to your eyesight? And at what angle should the mirror be focusing, either upward or downward?
Actually, what you'll find is that if you put the mirror just flat against the wall, and then you sit in a chair, like a recliner, so that your line of vision is slightly upward, like you're looking slightly upward into the mirror, and you've positioned the mirror in such a way that you don't see your own reflection. And if you put some black cloth or dark blue cloth behind the in the area that the mirror reflects, then that will exclude any reflection whatsoever. It's like you're like you're looking out into space.
Okay. Well, thank you, gentlemen. Have a very good night.
Thank you.
Okay. Next up, let's go to our East of the Rockies. You're on Coast to Coast. Hello there.
Nice to speak with both of you.
Thank you.
I thought I was the only person who ever thought in the manner in which you thought. Thank God I know I'm not nuts.
You're not nuts.
Hey, you know, when you spoke of logic, and a friend of mine had his father used to speak of the common sense doctrine, which in the last 15 or 16 years of my life I've applied and learned that for every action there's a reaction, and you really need to think things out. And you can't live your life by hypothesis. You know, you can hypothesize and pray and hope that that there's an afterlife, but to sincerely believe one way or another, I'm in your field. I'm in your territory where I don't know. You know, and I had a very bizarre experience when I was a kid that I don't know what to make of it either. You know, and there's somebody with the experience that I had. You would think that, well, you got to believe in, you know, an outer body. I don't know what to make of it, and then I'll keep it brief. When I was a kid, I was an actor. In the first movie I worked on, I had an agent. I told my agent at the time I was 16 going on 17. I said, I want to be in Second City. I want to follow John Belushi's footsteps. I want to work in Second City. I want to get there and get to Saturday Night Live. That was my goal as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
So during that week, I was practicing my DJing technique on the turntables, cutting it up in my basement, fell asleep at my DJ booth, and I don't know if it was a dream or whatever you want to call it, but I had a dream of Belushi. I hooked up with him. He's in my studio, and I told him, well, you know, when I get, I want to work just like you. And he says, well, fine. He says, if you want to get to Second City, he says, I'll help you, but if I see any of this stuff on your arm, and I looked at his arm, and it was like rotted Swiss cheese. He says, if I see any of this, he says, you're done. I'll make sure you never go anywhere. Mm-hmm. And I wake up in the morning, and about a week and a half later, I get an audition at Second City, and I wound up the youngest person ever admitted in the Second City. And I don't know what to make of any of that.
Yep. And, you know, I've had similar experiences. I know they happened. But I also know that I just don't have the mental equipment to figure out what they mean. I really have had quite a number of things like that happen to me in my life. And to me, you know, it's just like you're saying, I think that there's some people in the world who just seem to be terrified of saying three words, I don't know. But to me, those have always been some of the easiest words to say. I just don't know. And as a matter of fact, I enjoy the state of not knowing in the sense that because what's fun to me is to learn the rules of reasoning as clearly as you can and to apply them as rigorously as you can and to see what you come up with by that method. And what I have found in my life is that very few things are certain. I mean, even the most fundamental questions, if you start probing just a little bit, you get into all kinds of unfathomable things. And to me, that is just loads of fun. I am not embarrassed at all to say that I am an abysmally ignorant person, and that to me, the wonder of this universe and the amazing things that happen, and also it's a little bit amusing to me that there are so many people around who seem to think they have the answers. I mean, I think people who think they have the answers are by and large pretty dangerous people, I would think. I mean, and I always respect people who say that they really just don't know. But I am interested in the question. To me, the question of life after death is so important. I mean, isn't that the most important question? It seems to me that it is. And it's also, it goes back tens of thousands of years. It was studied by Plato, the earliest thinkers, and that these very great thinkers, the best thinkers that the world has had, have pretty much said, well, you know, that we ought to respect that question and to realize how really unfathomable it is. So to me, it's an act of reverence almost toward a question that important that we, you know, that we not rush into some sort of answer. I mean, what's the rush? I mean, I really do want to know. And what I'm doing is trying to figure out new methods to get closer to an answer.
With science so technologically advancing all the time, will we ever truly find scientifically the afterlife?
I don't know, George, but you know one thing, I'm more confident than anything else on this, and that is that before science can really give us the answer, that there has got to be a conceptual breakthrough. See what I'm talking about? Rather than some sort of scientific experiment, that what the breakthrough, I think, is not going to come from science, but from some conceptual field. In other words, that somebody will come up with some wholly new method of thinking about the question. I mean, you know, that word thinking outside the box is kind of hackneyed now, but I really mean in the literal sense, somebody who that is really going to have to be thinking outside the box. And again, I want to issue this challenge. I've been for 3 years making this. Just give me that opportunity to the 120 people in 10 groups. Give me 3 days each with them. Going by my rules, they have to work some exercises and go inside themselves and think out some, like they're watching a case presented in the court of law, for example. And that under those circumstances, I can make a genuine advance toward the rational understanding.
That's fair enough, Raymond, fair enough. We'll be back with final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, Dr. Walter Wagner joins us for the first hour to talk about small black holes being created by super colliders. And then physicist Dr. Ronald Mallett joins us. He's building a time machine. He wants to go back and see if he can find his father. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Raymond Moody with us, final segment, final phone calls as well. We'll take some more calls, and let's go to our first-time caller line. You're up with us. Hi there.
Yeah, first of all, I'd just like to say it's an honor to speak with two legends.
Well, one at least. Dr. Raymond Moody's with us.
All right. Well, my question is, there's a famous book by Kenneth Ring called Heading Toward Omega that's about near-death experiences. And it's from the early 80s, and it starts out, it has all, you know, the stereotypical near-death experience is described. But later on in the book, Kenneth Ring, he talks about how these visions about the future have been seen in different near-death experiences, and he found consistencies that predicted cataclysmic events for, at the time, it was going to be the late 80s. It was almost reminiscent of Y2K or 2012 nowadays. But we know these things didn't happen. So my question for Dr. Moody is, if he's familiar with the book, is this just a case where Kenneth Ring just kind of stretched his interpretations too far to reach that conclusion? Or does it cast doubt upon everything that we draw on from near-death experiences?
Well, what I can say is that back in the 70s, I heard quite a number, say about six or so patients that I had who had extremely lengthy cardiac arrests who had that same kind of impression. And I will tell you what my take on it was. And that is that... you sound like maybe you're a little younger, but if you can remember back into the early 70s, I have always been an inveterate follower of the news. To me, in the 70s, it really looked like Armageddon was coming. I mean, that was in the heart of in the middle of the Cold War II. Nuclear powers armed to the teeth, in conflict with one another and so on. And yet most people at that time were denying that. I used to be just astonished, for example, that back in the 70s, just you couldn't get people to listen to this. Hey, look at all these, this nuclear buildup. Where's this heading? These submarines, each containing many times the firepower of the whole of World War II in each submarine out there. And it looked to me like the logical projection that what would happen is eventually this would blow up. And I was really surprised and baffled when it didn't. What I always thought of those kinds of situations was that if you think about it, the approach of death is like an ultimate collapse of your defense mechanisms, right? I mean, when you perceive that you are dying, then the defensive structure that's served you well up to that point sort of collapses. And I figured that what was happening was that people in that circumstance were on the brink of death, that the denial that everybody had at that time kind of collapsed, and then so the mind raced ahead to make the logical conclusion, was that the way I put that together. And so in that sense, I think they were pretty close to right. I mean, in the sense that there was a big shakeup in the late 80s, if you think about it, the whole Soviet Union collapsed. But I have never thought of, and it just never occurred to me at the time to think of that as any sort of supernatural thing, but rather as just a, if you're in a situation where your denial is no longer working, then it seems to me that the mind would naturally race ahead and draw the logical conclusion from what was then happening, namely that you know, that we were in for a big shock. But I don't know. That's the way I always looked at that.
Well, thank you, Dr. Moody.
Thank you. Let's go wild card line. You're up with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
Hi. Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
Hello.
Angel Rider from the Nighthawk Zone.
Oh, I know that.
I wanted to ask Dr. Moody, have you ever heard of a similar experience? I had a near-death experience where three beings bathed in a blue light came to me. I couldn't quite make them out. And one spoke to me with a female voice saying that I would be all right, that I shouldn't worry, and I'm going to have a baby.
Mm-hmm.
Has anybody ever?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Presences come and sometimes not clearly visible, sort of hovering back, or you feel the presence or you see them vaguely, or various kinds of presences there that people feel are in a role of guiding them and trying to help them, or sometimes telling them to go back into their bodies, this sort of thing. Yeah, that's not.
Has anyone described a blue light before?
Yes, I've heard of blue lights and yellow lights and white lights. Yeah.
Huh. Okay, thanks a lot, gentlemen.
Okay, thanks. And say hi to everybody at the Nighthawk Zone for me. A great group over there. East of the Rockies, it's your turn. You're on Coast to Coast with Dr. Raymond Moody. Hi there.
Hi, Dr. Moody. You sound so much like Jack Nicholson. I want you to say, here's Johnny. I want a near movie experience, okay? But anyway, I've worked in the medical profession for many years, and I was always captivated by when people had coronary artery bypass surgery. Mm-hmm. Electronically, they have to stimulate the heart to stop it, and yeah. Then they put their blood, their life's blood, through machines and things. And so basically, they're dead. You know, I hate to put it like that. I don't want to scare anybody that's ever going to have heart surgery. But I'm sorry, but they are, in a sense, like artificially alive.
You're absolutely right in this sense, that if nothing was done beyond that point, they would be dead, right? In other words, it takes some intervention to bring them back from the state that would have naturally led to their death.
That's correct. And you know what? I read this small article in American in a journal where they said that some people, about 10 years after they had a coronary artery bypass operation, that some people have these I don't want to say premonitions, but they're more like feelings that something happened to them. And uh-huh. I talked to a lady one time that had. You know, once again, it's like about a decade after the operation.
Mm-hmm.
It was an odd, small study. And so my question actually to you is there any way to stimulate someone's memory of an NDE that was started by way of, let's say, surgical procedures? And mm-hmm. could it be unhealthy for the patient to try and stimulate that for them? Because I think it would be fascinating to try and get inside of the psyche of a person that didn't even know they had an NDE.
I would, indeed, I had that very thought very, very early when I was doing this. Because, like you, I had heard people say that, I talked with lots and lots of people who had cardiac arrest. And quite often you would have people say, well, no, I don't remember anything, but I have a feeling something was going on in that time or that I can't bring to my mind, and it seemed to change me quite a bit and so on. And so I had that very thought, and then I thought, well, maybe you could use, for example, deep relaxation. I hate to use the word hypnosis because that has associations with stage magic and so on, but hypnosis is nothing magic. Hypnosis is just a state of deepened relaxation and heightened concentration, essentially, and nothing magical at all about it. And so I wondered, you know, if you could do that. But I held back because I knew that under those circumstances, sometimes you can produce all sorts of physiological reactions in people as well. So I thought, well, what if I were to do that and to inadvertently precipitate a cardiac event or something? Well, so I held back from it. And then many years later, I mentioned to a good friend of mine who's a physician about that possibility. And I said, you know, I'd thought about doing it, but I held back for that reason. And this physician had a cardiac arrest. And he laughed and he said, well, you were absolutely on the right track there. He said, several years after his own near-death experiences, some of his colleagues tried hypnotizing him to bring back memories of this experience that he might have suppressed or put into the background. And when he did, he got neck vein distension. And I think that's potentially hazardous. And that's why I've never, I don't know that it really would be hazardous, but the point is that, do no harm, right? I mean, you just can't be fooling around with something like that where there's no real way of guessing in advance what the outcome might be. It could be harmful, and so therefore it's best just not to do it.
Raymond, the psychomantium room which you put together, the mirror gazing, isn't that enough proof for you that there's something on the other side?
You know something, George, I really do think that the problem is not so much in these experiences. The problem is in the question of what you could mean by proof by this. And, but I think that is where and I'm not saying this to be cantankerous or, evasive or obstinate or anything. I'm saying it because I think here is where the pay dirt is. I mean, if we pay attention to develop new methods of rational procedure that can enlighten us on this question that has always been intractable to science, then maybe we can expand our minds. I mean, I really do think that I'm not being negative here. I'm being positive and say, let's shift the way we look at it. We've been trying to make the big question of life after death fit into our narrow little methods of rational investigation and our analytical faculties of the intellect. I say, let's try a different way. Let's try to expand our minds and to extend our rational process to new methods that can give us a better handle on this question. See, that's my take on it. And I am predicting here and now this could really work. This really can shove us forward. I know it can.
Okay, let's take a final call or two, and that'll be it for tonight. Wildcard line, go ahead, please.
Hello, George.
Hi.
You had a guest about a week or so ago that wrote the book Politics, Prophecy, and the Supernatural?
Yes. Hello?
Yes.
Yeah, go ahead,
George.
Please.
Yes, you had a guest about a week or so ago who had a book called Politics, Prophecy,
yes,
and the
yes,
Supernatural?
Yes, 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 we heard you. Go ahead.
It was his theory that all of these things were a Luciferian endgame. I believe that Dr. Moody is a very intelligent person, and he's far too modest. But I think that he's being used in this Luciferian endgame, that these near-death experiences are of Satan.
How so?
Well, because he said that basically it didn't matter which faith you were from or if you didn't have a faith and you had a near-death experience, the experiences were relatively the same. Am I correct?
It doesn't seem to matter that much what the person's prior religious belief was, if any, and the content of their experience. Is that right? That's right. And holy mackerel, if I am in with the devil, then you are surely putting me in a powerful position. I mean, holy mackerel.
Not knowingly.
Not knowingly. Okay, and the guest, of course, was Lynn Marzulli.
Yes. Well, if I am ignorantly involved with the devil, then I just got to depend on God, I guess, to set me straight on that one. But, I'm just sorry I can't take that seriously. To me, that's like a joke. I mean, to say that somebody is in with the devil or unknowingly flirting with satanic forces, I mean, I'm sorry, that's just, to me, ridiculous with all due respect. I mean, that's just the way I look at it.
I'm sure you would.
Okay, fair enough. That's it. Let's go next to our West of the Rockies. You're on the air. Hi there.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. Dr. Moody, my name is Lynn, and it's a pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise, Lynn.
And to give you hope, that other person that just called and said that you were in the devil, we'll pray for him. And I have had four near-death experiences. One was in an emergency room when I was 14, and I've had experiences where I've helped people that have come back from having clinical arrest or cardiac arrest. And it's very interesting throughout my career that I would get a feeling and then the experience would come. And so this has been part of my life's work. And your book helped me. I think I read it when I was about 15 about how to control my dreams. So thank you.
Well, thank you so much for saying that. Thank you, ma'am.
All right. Well, just a few more minutes to go. And so many people keep calling you, Raymond. It doesn't stop. Let's go next to our East of the Rockies line. You're on the air. Hi there.
Hi, Dr. Moody. If there is life after death, here's the real problem. Those who believe that there is are taking the position of the serpent in the garden who told Eve that you shall not surely die. And, of course, a lot of Christian denominations take that position, the devil's position. So when we go to the Brookings Institute study about extraterrestrial life and what they thought would happen if it was discovered, this was one of the problems that doesn't get talked about on Coast to Coast but does come up. And when we talk to information scientists who believe that resurrection will be possible scientifically because of a transfer of information that would be consistent with God's position in Genesis, in telling Adam and Eve that they would surely die. Let's say George had a computer program, and he loaded it up, he sent it up to DARPA's computers, but then his own computer was destroyed. Well, it would be over for George and his originally mastered software program.
And the time has got us. Gosh, I'd love to get that finished, but Raymond, we're out of time. So you keep in touch. You're invited here, my friend, anytime you want.
All right, George, great. I sure did have a good time with you.
All right, thank you, Raymond. You take care of yourself. Dr. Raymond Moody, and he's the one. Interesting perspective, isn't it? For Steve Carr, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Latasur, Ross Mitchell, Alan Corbett, Stephanie Smithy, and Punnett and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.